Well, David, as we talk here earlier in the week before lunchtime, let's cut right to the chase and get to the thing that everybody is talking about. What the heck is going on with that Lakers-Mavericks trade?
Wow, I'm glad that was, because that could have gone in any number of directions. I'm so happy that you went in this one. I'm still trying to figure it out. It feels like a trade from another time. Like, it feels like a trade between the Kansas City Athletics and the New York Yankees in 1960 or something. Like, it just does yeah. not scan as a competitive deal between two teams in the contemporary NBA. Like, it is. There's a story I was reading right before you called by Howard Beck at The Ringer about, like, what kind of package Luka might have returned in trade had the Mavericks tried to trade him to any team but the Lakers. And the deal that they got, I mean, I don't say anything bad about Anthony Davis. He's going to go to the Hall of Fame and he's going to deserve it. He's a really good player. And there's probably like a 3% chance that the Mavericks somehow like brute force their way back to the Western Conference Finals. And everybody's like, I don't know. But Luka Doncic is 25 years old. Like, he's one of the five best living basketball players. The idea that they would do this trade for, you know, a decent enough return when they probably could have gotten four draft picks plus good players from the Oklahoma City Thunder, just for an example, is, you know, it's malpractice, I guess, but mostly it just feels like retro style malpractice. Like, it's not even cynical. It's just weird.
And I love the way Danny Ainge found a way to work his way in there. Like, let's see, if I can get into this deal and essentially do nothing but get a bunch of draft picks, could I be a part of that? Sure. Come on in.
So good. It's one of the real, like, the few of the, like, useful anecdotes from the Ramona Shelburne piece about it in ESPN was that he apparently did not even know which players were getting traded. That basically he got a phone call and they were like, do you want Jalen Hood-Schifino and a bunch of second round draft picks? You don't have to do anything. And he's just like, all right, yeah, sure.
Whatever it takes, sure.
I love second round draft picks. It's like if someone offers you M&Ms at a movie. Like, you're not in the reasoning part of your brain. You're just like, well, I'll take five.
Hmm. Absolutely. There's a big football game this weekend that I guess some people care about. I don't have a dog in the hunt, and I've said this. I don't dislike either of these teams. I'm just kind of tired of them.
Yeah, I think that's mostly how I feel about it, too. I mean, I think it's like a good matchup if you like watching football. I think there'll probably be some cool. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and say it. I think there's going to be some cool shit happening. I can use that word now.
Yeah, it's a podcast. It's a podcast, baby. Let her rip.
Now everybody can find out just how unpleasant I actually am to listen to. I'm no longer on my best behavior. But for all of that, I think that it kind of feels like it's been done, you know, and As a person who has demonstrated a knack in the past for being able to talk myself into a rooting interest one way or another, I really kind of can't in this one. Like, I have a little bit of respect and a little bit of disdain for both organizations and their fans. And at this point, you know, I would like the game to be competitive. I am hoping that there's a place that I can bet on how many AI-related advertisements will air during the game. That's the only thing I'm really dialed in on, though.
Now, Kerry Haskell, you're joining us from Super Bowl Central right there in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. How's it going?
Is there a buzz in the city?
Oh, it has been the talk of the town since, really the last month or so, but it has shifted into incredibly high gear currently. You know, there's a bunch of stuff. There is an incredibly garish light show being projected onto the St. Louis Cathedral, of all places. I mean, some of it's very nice, but the baseline of it is just like cartoony colors. But there's tons of stuff going on. I don't know how much of it I'm probably going to partake in. I don't know that I necessarily want to feed my money to the NFL. But I may go partake of it. I will say they have put up a lot of different artwork. They have done the NFL has done a good job. I saw their list of, recommended best restaurants to dine at while you're here for the Super Bowl. And they went outside of just like the ones that everybody would, you know, they mentioned some smaller neighborhood places, and they have done a good effort in that way. But then there's just some stuff that is very NFL-y in a city that they could have went a very different way.
I'm glad you mentioned that, though, because when you mentioned it at first, my thought was the NFL is recommending, like, you know, TGI Fridays and maybe a Chili's somewhere.
Yeah, or like partners of the NFL brand experience.
Yeah. I mean, there were. I was glad just to see not only did they avoid the chains, but they didn't just go for the high end places, right? It's not just Commander's or the other Brennan's restaurants or the Emerald restaurants. There's a little neighborhood place called Little Dizzy's on Esplanade that is a great place, and I was glad to see they were one of the ones on the list. Parkway Bakery, which
I was going to ask if they had Parkway on there. Parkway Po' Boys is a sandwich I've had once in my life, and I think I think about it every 72 hours. I'm just kind of like, I wonder how it's doing. I hope it's well. Like, that's cool. So, all right. In that case, maybe it's not a total wash. If the NFL is directing fans to Parkway, then they're doing something good with this game.
Yeah, and I realized I started off very negative, but there's a local artist that did the design work for the logo, and a lot of her art has been hung up as murals at different venues. I mean, and then the flip side is there are giant ads hanging off of buildings that never had ads hanging off them before. So they have turned sort of the warehouse central business district into a little bit of a Times Square billboard area. Which is a little jarring to see.
Yeah, I remember when the Super Bowl was ostensibly in New York. I mean, obviously the games are in Giant Stadium, which is in New Jersey, but they had what they called Super Bowl Boulevard that they set up running from Times Square down to Herald Square, which is not, you know, the part of New York. It's like the part of New York that everybody that's visiting here winds up in, whether they like it or not, but it is not, you know, there's not a whole lot there to recommend or to displace, and they somehow made it way worse than it was on an ordinary day. Like, it was just because it was basically what you were just describing there at the end, like the minus the, you know, emphasis on art or like local culture or whatever. It was a lot of rented event spaces for parties and such like, and then that space was just, you know, the Buick fan experience, or, you know, like, you could, there's a long line, you could see the Lombardi trophy, that was cool, but everything else about it was like, you could go into a tent and someone would give you a pamphlet about Jeeps and then you would leave.
Yeah, that's all set up at the convention center here in New Orleans, down on the waterfront. That's where the NFL experience is. Nice. I want to say it's like $20 to go in, and I imagine there's a lot of that. Oh, here, buy a Jeep. Be sure you buy our official spirits sponsor type stuff.
Yeah. You can wait 40 minutes for Scott Fujita's autograph. It's a chance you simply how could you let this opportunity go by?
It's a good game because it's two loyal followings, I'm sure, and on paper should be a pretty decent matchup. But I look back at the NFL season, and again, I don't really have a favorite team anymore since the Giants stink so much. It just wasn't.
It's liberating, though, right?
It is, but which means I can watch a lot of games and enjoy them. But there was a lot of bad football this year with so many really mediocre and less than mediocre teams.
Yeah, I think that was like really caught up to me at the end of the year, where there were. I mean, you know, obviously by the time you get down to like week 16, week 17, the good teams are trying not to get injured, but the sheer volume of stinky games in the average slate would be like, you know, even if you had the NFL ticket, like, you would just be like, there's nothing on at 1 p.m. You know, like, there'd just be like five or six games, none of them worth watching, which again, I think is like good for America in some ways. You know, like, it definitely got me going to the museums more over the period of time where ordinarily I'm kind of just like a like sad potato on the couch while my wife is like, remember when you used to have interests? And I'm like, oh, the Titans are on. Like, this was obviously way better, you know, for me in that regard. But yeah, it was a pretty lousy year in the sense that, like, I think on balance, there was more bad football played than good. And then I was disappointed just in the sense that the really fun teams did. I mean, they, you know, lasted a while, but the Lions were, for all of this year, like, to me, like, absolutely must see.
Yeah.
Programming. Like, they were just, they were really, really good. They were really fun. They were surprising. And then they were too hurt, you know, like, that just is how it goes sometimes, football being the way it is. And without them, I mean, like, the Eagles and the Chiefs being there is, you know, it's not an accident. It's not fluky. Like, they really were among the very best teams that were around. And yet, like, what's frustrating about it is that, like, not just that we've seen it before. I mean, I don't even think that this is like the, it's certainly the least electric and compelling version of the Chiefs that I can remember during this, you know, the three-peat push. And then the Eagles, Saquon Barkley aside, are still just like kind of the Eagles. Like, there's just like a big, you know, aesthetic donut in the middle of it where it's just basically deep passes and handing the ball off. And it's not that it's like boring exactly. It's just that if you watch the Lions, you're kind of mad that you're not getting to watch the Lions now.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. A big audience, I'm sure. It's sort of a given at this point. And who knows, the way things are going, maybe it's the last thing we do as a united nation here going forward. Speaking of
which, everybody.
Yeah. I mean, we held it off for, you know, approximately 12, 14 minutes here. And it's very dangerous to talk about any of this recording a couple days before this episode drops, because things are happening at such warp speed. But just, well, big picture, does any of what's going on surprise you?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I feel weird about it. I feel weird about it, but yes. I think that I had let myself sort of think that the Department of Government Efficiency would be a way for Donald Trump to warehouse Elon Musk and the various creepy nerds that he's got working for him, and just like get him out of his face. Cause like what Trump wants to do is sit behind the desk and go, well, I don't know, you know, or whatever. But that's like his, he doesn't want the spotlight off of him. And the extent to which Doge has been able to, I hate saying it too, man. It's insulting. like beyond the injury, there is the insult of just having to deal with the aesthetics and the naming of all this. But I didn't think that they would be able to succeed to the extent that they have in pulling the wires out of the walls. I really sort of thought that this would take longer. And I think the extent to which Congress and normal democratic processes have been sidelined is maybe I shouldn't have been surprised. Maybe I'm more shocked than I am surprised. It's not like I expected, you know, a normal or effective or, you know, non-horrifying presidency, but the way in which it is arriving, I feel like I wasn't prepared for, which is funny because I feel like, you know, that guy was just president. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It was like, that wasn't really that long ago. And I remember it pretty well. And I guess I just sort of, you know, maybe this is a lesson that I'm learning right along with everybody else. It's not like I had anything but the lowest possible expectations, but I feel like this has been worse and more, I'm trying to think of what the right word would be. I mean, just more flagrant in its disregard.
Oh,
and,
yeah. I mean, it's disdain. Just, it's so in your face, and it's that, what are you going to do to stop us attitude?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, the answers to that are the sort of things that you can't discuss online or on a podcast. But I think those are the answers to it, honestly. Like, I don't know what you do with something like this if they basically, if the courts, you know, rulings are not upheld. And again, like, you don't want to be depending on the courts. Like, you remember what the last 4 years were like, too. But I mean, it's just basically like, if you can't get there from here on any of this stuff, and these guys believe that their whatever, like 1.1% popular vote victory entitles them to take democracy down in the gut reno from within, then I don't know what you do there. It's a question of how much you value it and what you're willing to do to stop it from happening. And again, I don't want to talk about that sort of
thing. Well, and if you thought you were unprepared, it would seem at this juncture that Democrats in Congress were even less prepared because they don't seem to know what to do. Chuck Schumer, well, we'll wait him out a couple of years. He'll make a mistake. Oh, good. Good. That's a fine plan, Chuck.
There's a part of me, too, where it's like, I mean, I think that quote, which he gave to Semaphore, is like, it's from a longer, like, basically what he was saying is, we knew they would screw up, and they are screwing up, and we're going to benefit from that. And I think that even that, which to me has a kind of a criminal lack of urgency to it on top of whatever strategic shortcomings it has, it's still, I think that it's like not even a question of sort of fighting the last war. Like it is just, it's about, you know, 3-4 days behind on the news cycle, which in this moment and at the speed at which that cycle is revolving means that you're basically talking about a world that doesn't exist. Like there's nothing in this that suggests to me, like, yeah, I don't imagine that if like in the midterm elections that I think that the Democrats will probably do pretty well. I imagine that they'll take back the House. I don't have a hard time believing that. And yet what role has the House and the Senate played in any of the things that have happened in the last 2 weeks?
Mm.
So what do you expect to benefit from that? I mean, to me, that's like the question with any of this is that they're still, and I understand in some ways, like strategically, a lot of the decisions that the Democrats have made during this, where they're trying to, you know, bend but don't break, pick your battles, all of that stuff is good. But what it reminds me of, and this is a bad feeling, is just, well, I'll get to it in a sec. I think that they're pulling on levers that aren't attached to anything anymore. I think that they are counting on institutions that are not effectively a part of the process through which
and yet
governance is done.
Trump is still Trump, and we saw it in the first 2 weeks that you know, for every bold statement, there was an almost immediate retreat and reversal on so many areas because they don't know how anything works, and Musk knows even less about how things work. So I guess that's the hope that I hang on to, is that their incompetence and their short attention span will keep them from doing even greater damage than possible. And at some point, those two gigantic egos have to collide.
Yeah, I don't think that's naive, personally. Like, and I think that, you know, today, as we record this, it was basically the first time that I saw a significant amount of not just, you know, fight from Democrats, but they went to the USAID building and made their speeches, and there was a protest there, and they tried to get in and were turned away. But like Congress people did all of that stuff. And it wasn't the most inspiring thing in the world, but it was at the very least clearly attempting to make a case for what these institutions are worth and showing that you're going to fight for the public employees that work in them and going out and trying to get on TV as opposed to pushing some sort of message about the price of eggs, all of which is like, you know, and I understand, again, like why they think that the price of eggs is the most important issue here, because like there were a bunch of people that said that during the election. I just think that we're kind of through the looking glass to a certain extent in that, and that they're going to have to do a lot more of that kind of sort of shoe leather politics, getting out there, making statements, being angry and staying angry about stuff than Democrats have traditionally had the appetite for. And, you know, I hope they do it. I don't know what it'll add up to, but I certainly feel like capitulation is much less likely to deliver a result that anybody can live with.
We're talking with David.
The bit that I was going to
say. Yeah, go ahead.
That's to say, the thing that this reminded me of, and this is like, you know, the real sort of darker comparison to me, the bit that I cut myself off on. When I was at an old job, we were a union shop, and we also had as our owner it was basically a hedge fund represented by one, you know, like a private equity represented by one sort of rich dude who had made a bunch of money in online media a decade earlier and then came back and started bossing everybody around. And he was, you know, he fired one of our editors in chief. He pushed another one out. We felt, and this was a job that I wound up leaving, and then my former coworkers and I went on to start Defector. But when we were in the middle of that crisis, when it was basically becoming, he was telling us what we could and couldn't cover. He was, you know, sort of moving people out and pushing people around. We went to the union, and the union had an escalation strategy for how you would handle something like this. And it was tried and true in the sense that it had worked. It had worked at other places that I'd been. It's not a bad strategy. The issue was just that this guy was not a reasonable counterparty. And so there wasn't the sort of thing where you couldn't say, if you do this, then we'll do this. And if you don't do that, then you'll get this from us. It didn't matter to him. What we did didn't matter. Mm. And I think that in this case, and it was, I felt as if, you know, it was a very deranging sort of feeling to see all of these reasonable steps leading to just more and more unreasonable outcomes because of the fact that we were playing by different rules than the person that was trying to wreck us. And I think that that realization is going to be one that a lot of people are going to experience over the next few years. Doesn't mean that, you know, the future is over and we're stuck being ruled by an idiot king for the rest of our lives. It just means that some of Chuck Schumer's preconceived ideas of how this stuff is going to go are going to look very old very fast.
Well, and speaking of,
to come up with new ones.
Speaking of looking old and looking that way quickly, legacy media and I guess the most disturbing news recently, CBS surrendering, well, along with people not fighting lawsuits, which was ridiculous, in ABC's case, and then CBS surrendering transcripts of the 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris. And then, you know, of all people, it takes 90-something-year-old Dan Rather to eventually sound the clarion call that you can't depend on legacy media anymore, that we have to turn to other sources to tell us the truth about what's going on, because after 8-9 years, they still haven't figured out how to cover him.
Yeah. And I feel like at this point, I think that's an absolutely correct diagnosis. And I also think that it feels like it's going backwards. I mean, I think that there was initially after the election, this wild overcompensation, this idea that, well, you know, people actually want this. He did win the popular election this time. Like, therefore, you got to, you know, get on board with this program. And again, it's like, if you've ever watched Trump or followed what this is, it doesn't matter what you do. Like, there's nothing you can do that's going to endear yourself to him at some point. Like, it is like he's got his enemies and he's going to keep them until the day he dies. And there's no amount of sucking up to him that's going to change the way that that works. The thing that I think is like kind of most embarrassing about all of this is that, you know, what I think, if you believe that there are still laws that apply to things that are happening, CBS is in a much better position to stand and fight on this stuff than anybody else. And the idea of sort of paying a bribe, which is basically what they're doing in that case, is not just pathetic, it's also the sort of thing where like they would have won that case.
Yeah.
It's not that they didn't do anything wrong. And so the idea that you could somehow stop antagonizing a guy who lives to believe that he is being antagonized by the mainstream media, like, again, it's just the sort of thing where, like, did you just fucking hatch out of an egg? Like, are you not familiar with how this works? Like, we've all been here. It's been happening to everybody.
All right, so it go ahead, Kira. I was gonna.
Sorry, it is to me, and I don't want to be the alarmist in the group, but beyond just a failure of the media, it feels like a capitulation is what it feels like, and it feels that way at many other levels as well. I mean, yeah, the Democrats are trying to do something, but the Republicans, by and large, and are just sort of stepping aside and letting this illegal activity just happen. And at some point, even with it happen, you know, even with, you know, Schumer's, they'll make a mistake. Well, if you're going to sit around and wait for the mistakes to happen, it's going to be too late.
And a lot of people, and a lot of people can get hurt during that interim, you know, like,
right.
It's madness. I think that's.
I'm curious what you're both doing to cope, because I've been and I don't usually do this, but I've been an angry social media person now for about a week, which is not great for my my mental health. But I get
how's
fired.
That going?
Not great. So, and I know you have to walk away and take some breaks, but how are you guys balancing your justified anger and fear with taking care of the important things in life?
I should let Carrie go first because he might actually have an answer for this. What are you doing? Oh, boys?
Oh, man. I wish I had a good answer. It is tough. I the first Trump term, I was very, very vocal. And I still am somewhat vocal, but I've come to the realization that at this point, I'm just preaching to the choir. All of my friends and family that are Trump supporters, they're gone. They're not around me anymore. You know, and that's not been an easy thing to accept, is that, you know, people that I've known since I was a kid, they're just not part of my life anymore. But for me, that's part of holding people accountable, which is at its base, I think the main problem with the Trump administrations, both of them and Trump himself, he's never been held accountable for a single thing, or at least not faced a real penalty for anything that he's ever done. And neither has any of his administration. So at the least I can handle the people, but this time around, I'm trying to pick my battles. I'm doing smaller things. I'm trying, in light of the tariffs and the economy, I be honest, I am going to buy as absolutely little as I can for the next 4 years. And maybe some of these business people that think that Trump is so good for business will start feeling a little bit of the hurt and back off of their support of him. Because those are the people, and I said this to somebody else online today, the people you gotta watch out for are not the ones with the Trump banners out in their front yard. It's the coworkers, maybe the people you do business with that are quiet about it and aren't showing who they are publicly, but you know who they are. And those are the people that are the problem. That's where the real support for all of this is. It's, you know, the financial support and all of that. And so that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to take a look at where can I, you know, and monetarily is really the only thing you can do, is you can speak with your wallet. Where can I spend my money that isn't going to, you know, is going to maybe make a change?
Yeah, I think that seems reasonable. I mean, it's always tough when you get down to it and you realize that your foremost role in the country is basically as a consumer, and most of the choices that you can make are as a consumer. It's as a consumer, you get to vote every couple of years and, like, whatever, register your lesser of two evils preference for whatever is going on. I mean, that's been the real work for me this case, you know, in this particular go round, is trying to find some space where you feel like you have some agency and can, you know, not exactly live your ideals, I mean, or whatever, but just by, I don't know, compromise less, get more out of life, and, like, sort of let this chaos have less of a role in, you know, your day to day. And I've been working on just trying to do, you know, more stuff out in New York City, go to shows, go to dinner, go see my friends, well, you know, like, just basically connecting to other people, as opposed to, I mean, what I need to do is, I think, like, not unplug from the news one way or the other, but just get back, put the emphasis on the things that make me feel less insane and give less space to the stuff that makes me feel insane.
Well, and that, I don't want to seem completely negative, but yeah, you bring up a good point. That is something that I've been making a conscious effort. And again, it's, you know, one of the reasons I live in New Orleans is because I want to get out and do these shows. And I've been trying to get out and do the small, go to the small shows. You know, I'm not going to go to a Ticketmaster event, and I'm not going to go spend my money with the NFL. But, you know, I'm trying to go. I went to a little bookstore that I love that had a little blues trio playing there yesterday afternoon. I went, listened, you know, threw some money in the tip jar, bought something from the store, you know, and that's a good way to get out there and connect with the people that, you know, share the values that you do and are sort of in the same boat as you do, and do that in a positive way. So, yeah, I don't want to be completely negative.
So what I seem to be getting from you two guys is that perhaps my time could be better spent than my several hours a day of railing on Facebook and Blue Sky and my daily calls, well, not to Susan Collins' office, because I know that's going nowhere, but to Angus King. They're probably tired of hearing from me already.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that that's wrong to be calling them. I think that that's, you know, being on social media, I think, is just bad.
Yeah.
And I say that as someone who's on there all the damn time. Like, but it's the sort of thing where, you know, so you take it with a grain of salt. Like, America's foremost anti-Cheez-It activist basically just eats Cheez-Its all day long. Like, I am not the guy to be listening to on that. But I think that making those calls to elected officials, I've done a little bit of that, and that is very much not my style. And yet, I think that you need to let them know that you think that what's happening sucks and that you care about it. I think that hearing from normal people who wouldn't ordinarily be doing that is important. And again, you don't know where any of it ends up or what it adds up to. I mean, I think that what Carrie and I were talking to is basically self-care type stuff. Mm. And yet I think that that doesn't mean completely disengaging. I think that like what you're doing, as long as you're, you know, and I know that you are an educator, you're around people all the time. So it's not the sort of thing where your only connection to the rest of the world is like a little box with a blinking cursor in it or Angus King's voicemail. Like, you talk to plenty of people. But I think that, you know, some balance of that is
yes,
important.
Like, absolutely. It's,
you don't want to feel like you're just watching the world happen from a passive vantage point. That's the worst feeling of all.
I think what we need are more of these ludicrous, unexpected NBA trades to draw our attention away from the real madness out there.
It does feel especially like welcome at this moment. Ray Ratto wrote a post for us today at Defector that was basically advocating for a national trade deadline where every league that isn't the NFL just has, during this Super Bowl week, just everyone has to make one deal. Like, that we need this. And I think that, you know, I don't want to put too much pressure on, like, he was really expansive with it. Like, I don't think the National Women's Hockey League, they got other things going on. They shouldn't have to be out there making, you know, transfers or trades. But something that takes your mind off of it to some extent is very much welcome.
I need spring training to start so I can go back to being righteously indignant about the Red Sox not getting a right-handed bat. Focus my energy.
I am white-knuckling it so bad at this point because everything that I've been writing about has been like, do you ever feel like the entire world doesn't make any sense and it's ruled entirely by idiots? Like, it's not like it's going to get that much better when the Mets are going on too. Like, that's, I basically find a way to make all my Mets blogs about that as well. That said, like, I would love a dumb baseball thing to write about just so I can stop writing about the stuff that is otherwise my main topic.
Well, you're in Mets territory. Something dumb will happen, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's just a matter of, I mean, the clock is always ticking.
Count on that. David Roth, Defector, the Distraction Podcast. David, thank you. As always, now for the first time on the podcast, we hope you'll be a regular here like you were on the radio for all those years.
Well, I also hope to do that. It is great to be talking to you guys again. Feels like home. And I'm looking forward to, I always loved it when I would be on accidentally for like the 10,000th show or whatever. So if this is whatever, what is this one number? Like
episode 10, three, 12? Episode three,
episode three,
but clearly super. The best one yet.
This is good though. I like starting with the low numbers. This will make it when I'm coming back on for episode 1,209, it'll make it that much more meaningful, but very glad to be talking to you guys again. Thanks for having me.